The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. My name is Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here today with IJ Senior Vice President and Litigation Director Dana Berliner and IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara. In today's show, we're going to share with you highlights from one of IJ's most popular internal trainings called Law for Non-Lawyers. Once or twice a year, Dana leads a session for IJ staff to cover various kinds of legal claims that IJ brings, explain legal terms, and show how these concepts work in the real world of IJ litigation. These trainings cover a lot of ground, so for the show today, we're going to take it one piece at a time and ensure that the discussion really is a deep dive. Today's topic is standards of review. So, Dana, what are standards of review and why do they matter to a constitutional litigator?
So, standards of review really mean, does the court care and how much does the court care about the right at issue? So, some rights, the court really cares, and therefore they actually require the government to prove that the law has a purpose and that the law makes sense. When they care less, that level of proof and that level of scrutiny is just not required. So standards of review are critical for us because different rights are given different levels of scrutiny by courts. And courts are much more forgiving about, courts will approve laws that impede people's often economic rights way more than, for example, speech rights. And so understanding where the rights that we litigate fit into the standards of review and also how perhaps we can change the standards of review is a major part of what IJ does.
So where did standards of review come from in the first place? And how does the court sort of decide which rights it cares about?
They're mostly a historical accident, honestly. They're entirely made by judges, and there's nothing in the Constitution that tells you what standard of review something should get. There's nothing in the Constitution that actually tells you you need standards of review in the first place. And the system that has evolved is a system that kind of defies any rational explanation. So you have some rights that get very, very strong protection that are enumerated in the Constitution, like your right to the free exercise of your religion, and you have some rights that get really strong protection that aren't enumerated in the Constitution, like your right to travel. Then you have some rights that get almost no protection that are enumerated in the Constitution, like your right not to have your property taken away to be given to another private individual, and some rights that get almost no protection that aren't enumerated in the Constitution, like your right to earn an honest living or what the court calls pursue a common occupation. Now, all of these are rights the Supreme Court has held are protected by the Constitution. They're all protected by the Constitution. They just fall into different buckets based on how individual justices at individual times have decided to treat them. Kind of the cynical explanation of what gets how much protection, and I don't think judges are doing this intentionally, but it has remarkable explanatory power, is that the rights that get a lot of protection are the rights that are likely to be exercised by the sort of person who becomes a federal judge. The sort of person who becomes a federal judge has engaged in a lot of political speech and political activity. So those get a lot of protection. They've also done a lot of traveling. They understand the importance of being able to go from place to place. They probably haven't started a business. They haven't run a small retail store. And so the right to do that gets accorded less respect. That's certainly not explicitly what the courts are doing, but as a kind of offhand way of guessing how much protection a right's going to get, that's a pretty good explanatory tool, actually.
Just based on their ability to understand how much that right matters.
Right, just how much the right resonates with a judge.
And that really began the use of these, or the explicit use of levels of scrutiny began in 1938 in a case called Caroline Products, which has footnote 4, the most famous footnote in constitutional law. And so if you say footnote 4 to any lawyer, they will know what it is. This was the footnote in which the court articulated the idea that some rights, so they claimed, that were enumerated in the first 10 amendments, as well as rights that affected discrete and insular minorities, would get more protection. And other things, there would be more of a presumption that they were constitutional. and therefore less examination by courts. And it started in with Caroline Products, but the court has further developed that idea. So Caroline Products really only pointed to two levels of scrutiny. There are now three or perhaps more. And Caroline Products also suggested more scrutiny for the lowest level than, unfortunately, courts typically apply now.
And we'll go through each of those levels. But how did a footnote become come to have that much power? I mean, you'd think that that's the kind of thing that lawyers and justices kind of blow past all the time, right?
No, I mean, that's actually the amazing thing about the entire system is we've built this whole superstructure of standards of review on top of footnote four. And footnote four at the time was not considered an important part of the opinion. If you go through the papers of the justices at the time, Justice Stone didn't spend any time kind of debating what should go into footnote four or thinking about footnote four. It wasn't seen as articulating an important and timeless principle of constitutional law. It was just kind of a hand wave of maybe there's some stuff we're not deciding today. And that footnote has become the center of this entire intellectual system that actually doesn't have any system to it and kind of can't be defended on its own terms.
But it takes up a huge amount of constitutional law. Like, despite the fact that it wasn't that big a deal at the time, it's now honestly about half of what you argue about in constitutional cases.
Well, then let's dive into the different standards. So the first is strict scrutiny. What is that? What does that mean?
So strict scrutiny is when a judge looks at a law, he decides first if there is a compelling government purpose, meaning the reason for the law has to be really important, and then whether the law itself is narrowly tailored to achieve that purpose, meaning basically, does the law actually accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish? And in strict scrutiny, the burden of proof is on the government. So the government has to say, hey, we have this law because we're trying to accomplish this thing. And see, it works. We're doing this, and that's how we get to the goal. And that burden's on the government. So that's strict scrutiny.
It seems like that, you know, is what we would want to apply to the government in every case. But it actually only applies in a fairly few areas. Is that right?
Yes. So strict scrutiny for a long time, the sort of line about strict scrutiny is that it was strict in theory, but fatal in fact. And so saying something got strict scrutiny was the same as saying it was unconstitutional, which made courts very leery of applying strict scrutiny to anything. In recent years, that's kind of become less true. Courts are willing to uphold some things under strict scrutiny. It's become less fatal. But because it's such a strong level of review, courts are resistant to applying it to many areas. And so you get strict scrutiny for things like explicit racial classifications. And in IJ litigation, we primarily see strict scrutiny in our First Amendment cases, where we're arguing about restrictions on speech that hinge on the content of your speech. If the government's going to say you're allowed to say X but not Y, you're allowed to say go Cardinals but not go Yankees, then the courts are going to be very skeptical and the government's going to have an incredibly good reason. And one example of this is a mural case we have in North Dakota right now where the city was restricting who was allowed to paint art on the sides of their building based entirely on the message that the art conveyed. And the one city official actually said in sort of discussing the ordinance that the reason you have to restrict art is that if you let people put art up on their buildings, it might give people thoughts. It might make people think about things, and that could lead to debate. And it really was just suppressing speech because they were worried that if you have too much speech, people will get distracted by the speech and they'll start to have debates about the speech. And so we see strict scrutiny in cases like that. We also see strict scrutiny frequently in our educational choice cases where we make the argument that a government program is discriminating against people's free exercise of their religion by prohibiting them from going to a school as part of a generally available program, simply because that school also has religious aspects. There's a program that will let you go to any private school you want to learn math, but you can't also learn math if after math class you interact with an Episcopalian priest. And that is a burden on your free exercise of your religion. And this is something we're actually arguing about right now at the U.S. Supreme Court in our Espinoza case, which is a challenge to Montana's constitutional prohibition on providing any state aid to anyone to any kind of religious education. And we argue that that is burdening our clients' right to freely exercise their religion. They can learn math anywhere they want, except in a context that also has religion present. And the state has to have a really compelling interest if it's going to say, we're going to punish you for being an Episcopalian instead of being something else.
Well, and we're going to win that case, obviously. But so, Dana, overall, in areas where we have strict scrutiny applied to our cases, what is the track record like? In general, is it kind of what Bob was implying, that in general, if we can get strict scrutiny, we're going to win?
Yes, that's usually true. I mean, there are some things that can overcome strict scrutiny, like national security and other things that really relate to safety or preventing violent crime or things like that. So you can overcome it, but those kinds of justifications don't typically come up in our cases. I mean, one thing that's worth pointing out is courts usually, I mean, what Bob said is right. Strict scrutiny is usually considered fatal to the law at issue. But what does that mean? That means that most laws, if the government had to prove that they were justified, it couldn't. And that's
it's a powerful statement about the government's power and the way it's exercised.
Yeah.
In our cases, it's frequently the case that if strict scrutiny is going to apply, the government doesn't even bother trying to contest the case beyond that point. We have a case in Minnesota right now challenging a Minnesota law that allows wineries to operate and use imported grapes as long as those imported grapes are from Minnesota and not from any other state. And that violates the Dormant Commerce Clause, the part of the Constitution that says there's supposed to be a free market among the states. And what the precedent says is if the state's going to discriminate against out-of-state goods, it has to survive strict scrutiny. And so we asked the state, okay, well, if this is a strict scrutiny case, what is your compelling interest? What is your defense going to be? And the state said, we have no idea. We have no idea what we're actually trying to achieve with this. We're not going to bother. And in IJ cases, frequently there just isn't a good answer to the strict scrutiny question. And so it just the case ends there if it's actually a strict scrutiny case.
Either the reason for the law isn't actually important, or most likely the law doesn't achieve what it's trying to achieve, and the government, if they were asked, could not in any way establish that the law was doing anything that they were claiming. And therefore, I mean, really, either in strict or intermediate scrutiny. Which
what is intermediate scrutiny? Does that also applies to some IJ cases more maybe than strict scrutiny?
Unclear. Intermediate scrutiny is the box in which things are thrown that the courts don't quite know what to do with. They're not exactly strict scrutiny, but they're not as low as rational basis. They don't know what to do with them, so they say intermediate. And they say intermediate in a lot of different ways, so it's not entirely clear what goes in there, what doesn't. And often our cases, there's a big argument about which category the case will go into. If strict scrutiny is a law that is narrowly tailored to a compelling government purpose, intermediate scrutiny is a law that substantially relates to an important government purpose. So the purpose doesn't have to be quite as big a deal. And the relationship between the law and actually achieving that purpose doesn't have to be as tight, doesn't have to be narrowly tailored, but there does still have to be an actual relationship. And that, I mean, it seems obvious like laws kind of should relate to
that's
their
the
purposes.
Least we should be able, yeah, that we yeah. should have to ask, yeah.
So that is intermediate scrutiny.
Do you think that that comes a little bit from muddy thinking on the part of the court, the idea that they're not taking the time to figure out where it fits, and so they end up just throwing it into the box? Or are they trying to leave themselves some wiggle room with this? Or
I think a lot of it, honestly, is bullet dodging. A lot of the times when intermediate scrutiny ends up being applied in our cases, it's because we had a very serious argument that said strict scrutiny should apply. And in order to avoid deciding whether strict scrutiny applies, the court says, well, look, even if I only apply intermediate scrutiny, the government doesn't have enough evidence to survive. So I'm just going to apply intermediate scrutiny right now, and we'll save for another day whether you need strict scrutiny. Because there is this sense that applying strict scrutiny is this huge, momentous thing that courts should only do very carefully. And so there's a lot of temptation to say, I'm not going to decide the hard thing. I'm not going to do the strict scrutiny analysis until the government comes up with enough evidence to survive intermediate scrutiny. And in a lot of IJ cases, because we know what we're doing, the government's evidence doesn't survive intermediate scrutiny. So this comes up a lot in our tour guide cases, for example. We have a bunch of cases around the country challenging cities that have laws making it illegal to give tours to paying audiences without first passing a test and obtaining special permission from the government. And our position is that this is speech suppression. The government is deciding on an official version of history, and it's requiring you to demonstrate that you've mastered its official version of history, because when you go out on the street, it wants you to talk to people and answer questions about its official version of history. That's speech suppression that gets strict scrutiny. But courts so far haven't actually decided that question, because they've just said, well, wait a minute, what's the government achieving here? Most cities don't license tour guides. There's no evidence that you need to license tour guides to protect consumers from anything. And so who needs to decide whether this is suppressing speech or whether this is just consumer protection? Because if it's consumer protection, the government doesn't have any evidence that it's protecting consumers from anything. And so those cases have uniformly risen and fallen on intermediate scrutiny, kind of looking at the evidence the government can actually muster, instead of the sort of broader legal argument that IJ makes kind of in the background of those cases.
So a lot of what our listeners might think of as economic liberty cases at IJ, what people who speak for a living, you know, trying to earn their living by talking about things, giving tours, are constructed legally as speech cases. Is that's partly for that reason, to encourage the court to take the rights more seriously?
I mean, it's actually an interesting quirk of the law that simply because people speak for a living, they end up in a different constitutional box. And so when a court's evaluating a licensing law to speak for a living, it's supposed to do what the courts are actually doing in our cases, is saying, look, the government has come forward with all of these justifications about how this is protecting consumers, and they have testimony from a government official who says he thinks it's very important. But also, if you go 100 miles down the road, there's a very similar city that doesn't have a law like this, and nothing's gone wrong there, and they don't have any explanation for why nothing's gone wrong there, so I'm not going to take their assertions very seriously. That's the correct way to do intermediate scrutiny, and that's what's happening in those cases. But if you're challenging a very similar law that's accorded rational basis review, frequently what the court will do is say, well, they have testimony from a government official who says he thinks that this law is protecting the public, and that's enough for me. Because under rational basis review, the court is supposed to uphold the law if under any conceivable circumstances a rational person might believe it was advancing any legitimate government end. And so even though this government official who's testifying doesn't have any evidence, he doesn't have any basis for what he believes, I don't think he personally is crazy. And if he is not crazy, that's enough for me. And so I'm supposed to uphold this law.
And so this is a lot of the situation. You know, so we've talked through the higher levels of scrutiny, rational basis, the one we talk about a lot here within IJ, where most of our cases probably fall. Is that?
That's probably right. Certainly all of our economic liberty cases that do not involve speech will fall under rational basis. And a number of our property cases will also end up being under rational basis.
So where did rational basis come from? What is the story of this terrible thing?
Rational basis is something I think that, again, evolved purely through the courts. It's not found anywhere in the Constitution. It really wasn't even fully developed in Caroline Products, which was 1938, and it just sort of became worse over the years. And the idea with rational basis is strange. So the standard line is that the law has to be rationally related to a legitimate government purpose. So the purpose needs to be not something the government can't do at all, and it is supposed to be rationally related. And what that means is highly debated in courts. Certainly the courts will say all the time it's any conceivable purpose and you don't need evidence at all to substantiate the relationship between the law and its purpose. And the whether you need evidence or not is a huge debate that we are constantly litigating under rational basis. What's interesting is that the Supreme Court will always say that evidence doesn't matter, but sometimes it does. So sometimes the court actually looks at the evidence and says, ah, there's no evidence here. This doesn't make any sense. And sometimes they won't.
And sometimes so, they'll come up with a reason themselves, right? Occasionally the court itself will come up with a justification, even if it's not one that the government presented.
That's right. They'll just make stuff up. And whether the real standard is any conceivable purpose and any conceivable, I guess it's not any conceivable relationship, but plausible relationship, like all of the nuances of rational basis are something that we litigate constantly. Like, does the relationship have to be conceivable or does it have to be plausible? Meaning, could I completely make it up and it makes no sense, or does it actually have to make a little bit of sense? That's a genuine, hotly fought debate in the courts right now. The standard line is that the plaintiff, being the person who's challenging the law, has to have the opportunity to show through evidence that the law does not achieve any of its conceivable purposes. But sometimes courts believe you can show stuff through evidence and then we win. And sometimes courts don't care about the evidence and then we tend not to win. So how exactly to apply rational basis is really one of the major issues that IJ litigates in, you know, half of its cases.
So if the whole spectrum is not blatantly crazy all the way up to some evidence matters, are we always just trying to push – we're trying to push each individual court in any case that we bring toward the consider some evidence. Let's look at this.
I mean, mostly what we're trying to do is ground these cases in reality. I think there are two basic visions of what it means for something to be rational in this sense. It can be rational in the sense that a person sort of floating in a cloud using pure logic might believe this to be true. Or it could be rational in the sense that someone who is actually apprised of all the facts would rationally believe that this was a legitimate thing to do. And we think courts exist in the real world. We think judges exist in the real world. And we think, frankly, our clients exist in the real world and they're entitled to have their constitutional rights adjudicated in the real world. And so this is what we see play out in our cases. For example, years ago, we challenged Louisiana's licensing law for florists. And in Louisiana, it was the only state in the union where you needed to have a license to work as a florist. Literally, to put roses and baby's breath together, you had to pass two exams, a written exam and then a practical exam on which you were graded on the beauty and symmetry of your floral arrangements. And when we challenged
this— Which is not subjective at all.
No. You were graded, incidentally, by existing licensed Louisiana florists who were not wild about letting you into the market to compete with them. But when we challenged it, the state actually admitted there was no health and safety justification for the law. They didn't contend that floral arrangements were dangerous. But despite the fact that they admitted that, the first time we brought the lawsuit, our original trial judge said, wait a minute, my job isn't to be bound by what they're willing to concede. My job is to decide what's rational. It's sort of in the sense of this guy floating on a cloud. And I think it's rational to believe that this licensing law might protect people from infected dirt. Now, never you mind that no one in the history of, like, time has been killed by infected dirt. There's no connection between the beauty and symmetry of your floral arrangements and infected dirt. But if you're on a cloud, maybe you could think
that.
Crazy,
yeah, the crazy.
And So you can contrast that with what happened when we sued on behalf of the monks of St. Joseph Abbey, in actually the same overarching judicial district. The monks of St. Joseph Abbey wanted to build and sell caskets. They wanted to build traditional wooden Catholic caskets. There was a market among their parishioners of people who wanted to buy these traditional caskets. But in Louisiana, it was illegal to sell caskets unless you were a licensed funeral director. And the state of Louisiana said, this is about consumer protection. We want to protect grieving families. And if you're floating on a cloud, well, that's not a crazy thing to do. That's not an evil thing to do. I too would want to protect grieving families. But if you look at the real world, the only rule Louisiana had about caskets was that to sell them, you had to be a licensed funeral director. They could be made out of anything. They could be made out of wood, out of metal. You didn't have to be buried in a casket. You could be buried in a shroud. And the only people who weren't allowed to sell caskets were people who were physically in Louisiana, like the monks. It was perfectly legal to buy caskets on the internet and have them shipped to you. And so when you actually look at all the facts on the ground, it genuinely becomes crazy to think that they're doing this to protect the public from anything instead of to protect the profit margins of licensed funeral directors. And that's exactly what the court said. You know, rational basis is deferential, but that's different from saying it's fantastical. That's different from saying that we need to close our eyes to reality and pretend things are happening on the ground or aren't happening on the ground when that's contrary to the actual record before us. And that's really what we say rational basis review has to be. It requires a more deferential standard than strict scrutiny, but what it doesn't require is fantasy. We're not dealing in sort of the realm of the imagination. We're dealing in the realm of actual people who have actual constitutional rights and real interests at stake, and they should be taken seriously enough to actually have their rights reviewed in the context of the record they're able to build instead of in just the abstract notions in someone's head.
Well, and both of the cases that you mentioned were federal, under the federal constitution. Does this change at all, Dana, if you're talking about state constitutions? Because we're increasingly bringing more of these cases, the rational basis cases, under state constitutions.
Yeah, that's right. And so state constitutions are really interesting for these kinds of rights. Most states have several different lines of cases, they're called, where you know, a case will decide something, then another case will cite it, and then another. And they will have one line of cases that sounds like the worst federal rational basis. Any conceivable, courts can make up stuff. They'll have another line that sounds, if not like strict scrutiny, maybe like intermediate, or they don't even talk about a level of scrutiny, and they just look at whether the law does what it's supposed to do. There will be one line applying what's called real and substantial scrutiny, which by its title, you can see that there has to be some aspect of reality involved in it, and substantial meaning that the relationship has to actually be something. So there will be these different lines of cases. Typically, they don't cite each other. So you'll have a court one year decide under one line and the next year decide under a different one, and they won't try to reconcile them. And so IJ has decided that this is a really important opportunity to go to state high courts and say, okay, you've got this total mess of case law, resolve it and pick something that actually makes sense, applies in reality, and requires there to be some actual justification if you're going to violate somebody's rights. So that's something that we are trying to do. And the classic case of that we did is the Patel case out of Texas that involved women who were doing eyebrow threading, which is a way that you can pull out hairs on
clean
the
up
face
your eyebrows,
with
yeah.
a piece of thread. And they were being required to get an esthetician's license, which was like 600 hours of class during which you did not learn to remove hair with a thread. And you learned a lot of other stuff, but not that. So there was really just no relationship between this very arduous educational requirement and testing requirement and what you were even going to do. or the safety of what you were even going to do. So Texas, like all of these other states, had a bunch of different lines of cases that never cited each other and made no sense together. And we went to the Texas Supreme Court and said, you should be applying real and substantial scrutiny. You should pick between this mess, decide which one you're going to go with, and you should pick something that happens in reality that requires that the law actually make sense, actually achieve its purpose if you're going to violate somebody's rights. And in addition, Texas had a history of also asking the question of whether the law was unduly oppressive, meaning is it just requiring so much to achieve something very small? And that then became, so the Texas Supreme Court went through all of that and it did decide to abandon its line of cases that were more deferential and to apply real and substantial scrutiny to look whether the law was unduly oppressive. And that now is the standard in Texas. And we're trying to bring cases like that in other states so that at least under state constitutions, it will be clear that courts have to look at what the law is actually doing, because many of these laws, you know, destroy people's careers. And it's really important. There has to be some kind of reason they're doing it. And that gets lost sometimes, especially in federal court. And it kind of goes back to what Bob was saying about people operating in a cloud. Like, the courts forget that someone's, you know, financial stability and family and everything may rise or fall on the decision in the case, and they're not even really paying attention.
And that's the really nice thing, I think, about the oppressiveness standard in Texas. That when we talk about federal standards of review, it's very easy, and I do this myself, to fall into the trope of talking about what the government's doing, what's the government's interest, and how closely is this tied to the government's interest. And oppressiveness really puts the focus where it should be, on the individual. The state of Texas may be trying to do something great. It may be doing something wonderful. We're not saying cosmetology school is bad. We're looking at this particular plaintiff. And is what you're doing to this plaintiff justified by what you're hoping to achieve? And in that case, for example, Texas made the argument that parts of the cosmetology training involved hygiene and involved cleanliness. And hygiene and cleanliness is important to threading as well. And the court said, fine, that's great. Hygiene and cleanliness is great. Making them go to this amount of school to essentially learn to wash their hands is unduly oppressive. That's not something you can't do to anyone across the board. Our concern is with these people in front of us. And I think that's really a healthy place for a court's attention to be.
So just to wrap things up with your thought, it sounds like a lot of our strategy is constructed around the levels of scrutiny that exist. Do you see a court-created thing from about 100 years ago? Do you see it ever going away, or is this sort of the future of IJ litigation and all constitutional litigation?
It's hard to imagine it completely going away. It's so deeply ingrained now in constitutional law. But it's also possible to see some of it eroding. So for a while, things that were strict scrutiny were drifting into intermediate, and things that were intermediate were drifting into rational basis. Now it seems to have shifted perhaps back the other way. And for example, the Supreme Court said in the Heller case, which was the one about the Second Amendment, that they'd never applied levels of scrutiny. And since they'd never applied it there, they just weren't even going to deal with levels of scrutiny. They were just going to look at the law and see whether it achieved its purpose and not talk about, was it intermediate or was it strict or what was it? So that, I thought, was a good sign. And hopefully courts will begin to pay a little less attention to levels of scrutiny. I've heard that the court is sort of less interested in that as a topic right now. It also, we hope, will be that we'll be able to move rational basis to a little bit more reality-based than at least some courts apply it now, and that that too will improve the situation. But it is hard to see it going away altogether, though I'd love to see it going away altogether. What do you think, Bob?
I mean, even if you, and I yield to no one in my disdain for the three-tiered system of review, but when we talk about standards of review, I think fundamentally that's just a proxy for arguments about how important certain rights are and how much trust we should have in the government in different areas. And those are just important fights we're always going to have, whether we sort of couch them in these cloudy standards of review terms or whether we just have them outright. That's exactly the argument we need to be having as a society and need to be having with each other and with judges, is how important these rights actually are. And part of IJ's central mission is to raise these basic rights, like your right to earn a living, to an appropriate place in the firmament of American rights, that that's actually a tremendously important moral right. And it's not an area where the government's track record suggests that nobody should be checking its homework. Whether you call that an argument about standard of review or whether you just call that an argument about how heavily we should presume the government is acting beneficially, I don't think that makes much of a difference. That's still the same fundamental argument you have to have. It's the same fundamental argument you have to win. And I think it's that argument that IJ, above all else, is really aimed at.
Well, that's a great way to end today because we're out of time, but there will be more of these discussions. Thank you, Bob and Dana, for joining us. If you enjoyed the conversation, stay tuned because we will be digging into other aspects of the law in future episodes. Don't forget to follow us and to subscribe, and you will be one of the first to know when those are released.